Thank you for your introduction earlier, Matt, and thanks, Ken, and thank you to CEDA for this opportunity to come and, as Ken said, reprise what we did a few weeks back. So some of this might be repetitive, so I'll make the same apology as Ken, and I'm glad that Ken clarified the relationship that we have. My wife has had doubts at times for the number of late-night phone calls. The DBNGP, I won't repeat what Matt said about the company and the pipeline. I think most people know what it is. One of the advantages that it has in terms of security is that a lot of it is in the middle of nowhere. A lot of it's a long way in from the coast. We talk about the security of the pipeline, and a lot of it is so far away that it's very hard to find. So what happened in June? This is a graph which shows the gas received into the DBNGP from all sources across the month of June. You can see at the beginning of the month about 850 terajoules a day was coming in, and on the 3rd things all of a sudden stopped. Then there was gradual increases during the month as we saw North West Shelf start to ramp up its production. But they were moving into production territory where they hadn't been before, and there were plant issues in really pushing the plant beyond what its design capacity was, and did an excellent job, but that requires bringing things up and taking things down and trying and adjusting. So there was a bit of engineering on the run, I think, going on to try and recover that extra 100 terajoules a day that they were able to provide back into the market. So the gas delivered out of the pipeline is probably an even more interesting picture there to compare what happened in the north and the south. Ken mentioned that some came south and some stayed in the north and the east, the east being down the goldfields. If you look at that top graph, the blue one, the Pilbara and goldfields, there we have a lot of large, sophisticated mining operations. They're in the trading game. That's what they do. And they were very early movers to secure alternative supplies. You can see the dip there was only for a day or two before they got on the phone, cut their deals, and secured alternative supplies, and ran then fairly stable. Okay, reduced production, but it was a fairly stable operation in the Pilbara and the goldfields. The southwest is a totally different story. It was much slower to react. It is very reactive, it's a price-sensitive market. You've got the mums and dads gas market and electricity market, which vary throughout the day and throughout the week. And it was a market which is relatively price inelastic, so they're not able to pay extra money. And the retail market is price capped, so there's no opportunity there. If I wanted more gas at home, I didn't have the option to say I'll pay some more for it because of the tariff structures that are in place. So what we saw was the fluctuating residential demand really driving what the retailers were able to do in terms of supporting the small industry and commercial markets. The residential market, really the first half of the month, you can see things were pretty good, people doing the right thing, but then around about the 15th or 16th, it started to get cold, and you can see there the gas heater started to come on. In terms of the pipeline operations, I think we went into this in probably ideal conditions. The pipeline was full of line pack or inventory in the pipeline. The pipeline actually holds about 2,500 terajoules of gas at any one time in its current configuration. Of that, we need 2,000 to maintain stable operation. So there's about 500 cushion at the top, which allows the pipeline to load follow. So we were able to support balancing out of that 500 terajoules at the top. We can support balancing the time lags between production and demand. So that's as North West Shelf was coming up and going down, the load was moving at different times, the pipeline is able to manage that with that 500 terajoules of inventory that's sort of the swing inventory. We had a bit of instability at the bottom end from the middle of June as the residential load first started to come on. Fairly normal in the middle of winter when that load first starts to come up. You start adjusting your operation to match the load. We had one little issue there in the middle of the month. We had a communications fault. Suddenly everything went dark for a couple of hours. It was like, whoop, what happened there? But fortunately it was merely a communications relay that failed. It was repaired immediately. But throughout the whole period, there was no threat to deliveries from pipeline operations. So what did we specifically do to stabilise the gas supply system? First thing we did was to secure our operations. We stationed people at the top three compressor stations on the pipeline to make sure that any event that occurred up there, we had instant response. We rescheduled all non-essential work so that those guys were basically there as emergency response. They had a pretty boring job for a while. As Ken said, there was close cooperation between the infrastructure operators, between ourselves and Ken and his control room. Alinta Gas Networks, as the network operator for the gas supply system around Perth in the southwest, it was never really under threat, but of course they had concerns about where it was all going. We also had communications with the operators of the other two major pipeline systems in the state, with Epic Energy with the pipeline out to Port Hedland, and the APA group with Goldfields and the Parmelia systems. We then set the pipeline up at the top end to maximise receipt capability, that is, push as much gas south as fast as possible, so keep those top three compressor stations running pretty hard, push the gas south so that there's a nice big, what we call a hole at the top of the pipeline, as the pressure at the top is relatively low, to allow North West Shelf to flow as much as they could possibly get out of the plant. We also, with some of those other operators, negotiated or discussed a release from some minimum pressure obligations, which allowed us a bit more flexibility in operation. The pressure obligations related to customers that weren't on, so it didn't affect anybody. So we maintained a receipt capability that we could take over 750 terajoules a day constantly throughout the entire event from the North West Shelf plant, where normally the pipeline set up that would take between 600 and 650 without any problems, without having to adjust things, but we actually cranked it up to make sure that we had enough space there for 750. We also commercially established some emergency services to overcome some of the contractual shortcomings that some people faced, to allow them to take advantage of the additional gas supplies that were coming into the market. And significantly, we had a significant request for data from government, and so we were providing the Office of Energy with pretty regular updates on the stability of the gas system. So what were the key impacts? I think we all know what these are. There were two major industrial plants that were shut down for the duration, and neither of them is yet back up to full production, at least from what we can see from the gas supply system. The small and medium industries had production curtailed fairly severely, and there was a lot of press coverage about that, and I'm sure Trevor will talk about that in a bit more detail. And a lot of their problem was, am I going to get gas tomorrow? There are, again, difficulties in the market rules and the contracts about switching between suppliers on short notice. And the bulletin board that the IMO set up did certainly help to provide opportunities for people to do some of those trades once that was established towards the end of June. There was significant increase in costs, even for those who were still running, had massive increase in costs. Ken just showed you how much oil the electricity system burnt during June. Well, that continued on for several months, and that oil doesn't come cheap. With three coal plants available, it exacerbated the problem. And what we saw was residential customers doing the right thing. Certainly the residential demand for this June-July was lower than we would have expected in a normal year, to the extent that from the pipeline we have visibility of that. And we've heard plenty of anecdotal stories about people having short cold showers and reduced heating and lighting, and that extended through into the commercial sector. So lessons learned, which is really what we're here to talk about. From our perspective, our emergency response on the pipeline worked well. We kept the system stable. We were very fortunate to be in a good operating state at the start of the whole exercise. We had a very good response from most shippers. It took some people a few days to actually ramp down their production and to grasp the seriousness of the situation. But generally... we had a good response with people backing off their load and not pushing back too hard, and we didn't have contracts being banged on the table. We were asking for a pragmatic response, and we'd sort out the contractual arrangements later. The cooperation between infrastructure operators, and particularly between ourselves and Western Power about the electricity system, Ken showed you there the... some of the difficulties in oil supply at particular stations. there was pretty constant communication about, oh, if we can we burn gas for a few hours now, if we back off later because we're waiting for some distillate trucks. In planning our operation of the pipeline, we were using worst-case assumptions. Once we got the phone calls from Varanus Island and then from our control room to me and my team, we had a pretty fair idea that this wasn't a 2 or 3 day problem. This was going to go on a bit longer. So we immediately assumed that we were facing a month plus. So we were modelling on a new steady state of the pipeline. We weren't going to do what we did in January, where we let a lot of that 500 terajoules of inventory go in the first 48 hours, to the point where, as Ken said, if we'd gotten in January through to Monday, we would have had a real problem because we'd used up our emergency stock, if you like, in those first couple of days. This one, we could see it was going to be much longer, and so we held back on that, and we gradually adjusted our operation and gradually released that that inventory to manage the system over over a much longer period of time. One of the problems that we faced was the commercial confidentiality issues that come around the contractual environment that we have, which does limit the amount of information flow that we can receive and that we can also deliver to people. So I'm not saying that we need to change it, it's just it is a reality and we need to work around it. So there's going to be a panel session later, so I thought I'd throw up a few thoughts. One of the first issues that we faced was, do we declare a gas supply system emergency? I have the power to do that, to ring up Jason Banks or ring up the Minister's office and say, you have a problem. Literally it becomes the Minister's problem. I can basically go and jump on a plane and go to Bali and leave the Minister to look after the pipeline. It's a real sledgehammer. There's no staged process for declaring an emergency. You either have an emergency or you don't. That was not invoked. We weren't really in an emergency. It wasn't that bad. It required very, very close and very tight management. But there are no mechanisms for the government to actually step in and do anything other than provide an advisory role and a coordination role, which they did perform. The market mechanisms, as you could see from those early, that early slide, the market mechanisms work pretty well for the big players. The miners in the goldfields all did their deals in the first couple of days, locked down. Some of them closed down their operations and sold their gas to their mates because gas was more valuable than the product they were producing. But they did their trades because they're traders. That's what they do. They also have fuel options where the people were trading, I'll burn distillate and sell you my gas if you pay for my distillate sort of deal. So those deals were going on up and down the market. The problems really came in the retail market, and retailers being asked to match supply with price in a price cap market in the small industrial and commercial sector, they really did have some challenges. Some of those challenges around the market rules, and the bulletin board sort of helped, but it took a little while to establish. Plus, the size of trade becomes a problem because, you know, really you're getting into very small trades, and the cost of the trade is worth more than the gas. And then the economic feasibility of some of the mitigations that have been talked about. Yes, I have to say, two empty pipelines is no better than one. So, if the problem is a supply is a production plant problem, all the pipelines in the world isn't going to make a difference. So, storage has been talked about. How do we do that? Underground storage, Mondarra played its role, but we don't have the right geology in Western Australia for significant underground storage. Pipeline storage, yes, it can be built, but again, you're putting a lot of money in the ground for pipe that's going to be used once every blue moon. LNG storage. Anyone who thinks LNG storage is the saviour for the market, take a drive down to Kwinana and have a look at this nice big shiny sphere on the Wesfarmers site down there. There's a brand new mini LNG plant down there with a storage vessel. Perth uses 7 of those every day. And then alternative fuels. Well, I think Kent hit the nail on the head. The distillate market responded. It provides the flexibility and it did the job. It comes at a price, but at least it kept the system running. And, of course, the big question in all this mitigation is who actually pays for it. Who are the beneficiaries? And we as a society and as a state need to make those decisions as to whether it's a state investment in security for the state economy or is up to individual companies to protect their own positions and put in place their own risk management and risk mitigation strategies to look after themselves. I mean, that's the big decision. Any of this stuff's possible. It can all be built, but someone's got to pay for it in the end.